1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. By the way, listeners will remember, it's a good year ago now, we had calls from ex-students, ex-Jesuit students, either in Belvedere or indeed in Limerick, the Crescent in Limerick, about what was a priest long-standing there, a Jesuit known as Father Joseph Marmion. And they were making very, very serious allegations. And indeed, the Jesuits admitted at that time that he was a paedophile. He died in the year 2000. Well, we've now been sent a copy of the internal Jesuit report on Joseph. They now call him Joseph Marmion. There's no reference to his ecclesiastical status. And it's we're going through the report as I speak. But I can tell you already, I can see that the report is a template of all the other actions by the church when it comes to allegations of sexual abuse. In 1948, they had misgivings about Joseph Marmion. The Jesuits had misgivings about Joseph Marmion. That's 1948. 54 years later, they reported him to the Gardaí. By the way, he's 2 years dead at that time, and it got full honours in terms of a glowing obituary in their internal annual. And indeed, he's buried in the Jesuit plot. I only saw his grave there recently myself, up in Glasnevin, and he's referred to as Father Joseph Marmion. And in 1977, they now admit that they received. Now, some of our callers said they were aware earlier, but the Jesuits are now admitting in this confidential report that it was in 1977 that they first got, they say, credible allegations of sexual abuse by this man they now admit was a serial paedophile, Joseph Marmion. But what they did in 1977, again, was exactly what every other clerical organisation seemed to do, and indeed other organisations as well, and that was cover up. They moved the perpetrator. There's no paper trail. There's no record of an investigation. And the Jesuits, who did they report Father Joseph Marmion and his crimes? They were crimes too. They reported it to each other. Within the organisation. One Jesuit reported to another Jesuit who reported to another Jesuit, and it disappeared, and they simply transferred Marmion. And believe it or not, even knowing that he was a paedophile at that stage, the Jesuits allowed Father Joseph Marmion, when he was bounced out of Belvedere because of his behaviour, they allowed him become a chaplain to a hospital, St. Vincent's Private Hospital, which from time to time we've now discovered would have had children as patients, believe it or not. So the Jesuits hid everything about this man until they were forced by victims like you heard on this programme to speak out. Now, they do say they are extremely contrite in their document, and we'll talk about it in a few moments when we put it all together, so to speak. That's the confidential report by the Jesuits into themselves. But it's pretty damning, even though it is into themselves. But let's begin with a phenomenon of this summer, which is these casual pop-up chip shops, coffee shops, horse boxes, everywhere around the country, doing great work and great business, thankfully. But Saoirse Roche. Saoirse, good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi, Saoirse, and I know your mother is there as well. Your mother, I'll go to your mother first, Annie, because she wants to give us the background.
Hi.
Annie is on WhatsApp there. That's why you're not on my screen. Annie Roche, good afternoon. Just tell us about Saoirse and what she's had to endure.
She first started a summer job. She was delighted with it in May, her first ever job, because she's just turned 16. And I think at the very beginning, she loved the job and loved, mm-hmm. She's very outgoing. She loves having a few bob. But over the very recently, I think especially since the pub, some people are back in drinking and stuff like that, she's had to endure a lot of what I would refer to as sexual harassment for her age.
From men, usually
older men.
And what do you mean older men, Saoirse? Sorry, Anne. Annie, I'll come back to Saoirse. You stay there for a second. Annie, what do you mean by older men?
Well, this kicked off last week when I tweeted about it, but she came home quite upset because she was talking specifically just during the week there about a man in his 40s, mm-hmm. and she's just 16. And he came up, he was after a few drinks, and this isn't very late. This is like 7 o'clock in the evening. This is daylight hours. And this is out in the open. out because she's inside in a little van serving people.
Yeah.
And he came up and kept asking her, you know, telling her she was good looking and asking her out and stuff. And then she told him that she was only 16 and he told her it didn't matter.
Oh my God.
That he told her he'd take her home with him and buy her some drink. And there's another girl working with him who herself is young. She's only in her early 20s and mm-hmm. asked that man to back away and leave the girl alone, that he was clearly making her uncomfortable and she was a minor. And his reaction to that was then to start insulting that girl. He started calling her ugly. He kept telling her she was just jealous of the attention, and then kept turning his attention back to Saoirse, who, is, as I said, made it clear she was only 16 and had no interest. Thankfully, there was another man who wasn't a mm-hmm. customer but overheard in a distance what was going on and came over and intervened and made that guy leave.
Good.
And that was one of the worst ones. But she's had a lot of attention where she has come to the point now. The difference I think I see in her from when she started a job just in May to now is that now she'd be there before she goes to work and starts asking me, how do I look? Do you think what I'm wearing is going to draw attention?
Oh,
and
gosh.
She's just talking yeah. about a plain black pants and runners. Yeah. And last week, especially in the heat, she was trying to wear something that she wouldn't be too hot in a hot environment, but was also very worried that if she showed any skin, she would draw too much attention. And at 16, she shouldn't be worried about that, standing
absolutely
behind the counter,
not.
Being
and
responsible for the actions of these people.
The other difficulty, it's not a shop, so there's no door on it, so to speak,
no.
where you could say to
no.
somebody, no, you're not getting in. Anyone can come up to the chip van or the coffee shop in the horse box. Anyone can walk
yeah.
up to the counter, basically, and quickly...
Yeah, there's no hiding from that.
Quickly disappear. Saoirse, as I said, is on the other line. Saoirse, good afternoon.
Hi.
I'm so sorry that you have to go through this. When did it start, Saoirse, this abuse?
The first time it happened was a few weeks after I started.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a man that comes up regularly. But the first time it kind of happened, other than that one usual man,
mm-hmm.
was 2 weeks ago. And I've had another group since then. So I've had a total of three incidents.
And
three times, with yeah. different people.
Different men?
Yeah.
And you've had to say to them, listen, I'm 16.
Yeah.
And the problem is there's no door. They can't be barred from a pop-up chip van or a pop-up. They can keep coming to your counter.
Yeah, they can. And they do.
And they do, okay. And that's the annoying part. You made it clear that they were upsetting you.
Yeah.
And they continued.
Yeah, it is.
Now, are you the only young woman working in that van?
No, there's another girl I work with and she's in her early 20s.
Okay. And is she abused as well in this way?
Yeah, she does get it a lot as well.
Okay, and the problem is, well, apart from calling the Gardaí, but they'll be long gone by then, you've no power. You can't say you're barred from the chip van because they could just walk up to the chip van at any time.
Yeah.
Though you can refuse to serve them.
Yeah, we can.
Yeah, okay. And do you feel, how do you feel when they say these awful things to you, Saoirse?
It makes me feel very self-conscious.
Yeah.
And, last time it happened, I just kind of wanted to go home and change and then come back.
Well, you shouldn't have to do that. That's outrageous.
And, I noticed that since I started, before, I would never worry about what I was wearing, really.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But now, in the last few weeks, as it's been happening a lot more, I've been kind of asking, ma'am, is what I'm wearing okay? Is it too revealing? And
my
I've been
God.
Noticing, I've been looking in the mirror a lot more and noticing it a lot more.
Has anyone been barred, so to speak? Have you said to any of these louts, no, you're not getting served? Or would you be afraid?
I'd be afraid of the reaction I get because a lot of the time when they come up, they are drunk.
Yeah.
And you'd be afraid in case, you know, they might get a bit violent or go a bit far,
Okay. And your manager, you say, has been very good.
Yeah, he's been very good about us.
Well, he can't be there all the time, can he?
No, he can't.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And again, it's the vulnerability of being in a van. You're very vulnerable there. You've nowhere to... The only place you can run is out the van into where they are.
Yeah.
You can't run into a back office or go up to the bathroom or whatever, because there isn't one. And we are you tempted to give up the work, Saoirse?
No, I just, I guess, kind of, I dread them coming up. Yeah. I haven't gotten to the point yet where I feel like quitting, but we, because we're kind of able to turn around and tell them to go away, and they do back off a small bit, but it is reoccurring. Like, as I said, there's one man that does come back an awful lot.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows I'm 16, and he says this every time. He says he knows I'm 16, but that, you know, kind of sly remarks of that no one would find out or anything.
Oh, God. And what age is this man?
I'd say he's in his 50s.
And are the men who are saying these things, are they older men, so to speak?
Yeah, way older.
And what would your own age group say to you, if anything?
My own age group is they're very innocent, very shy. They'd come up and they'd be very, like, awkward, and they might ask you for your Snapchat or whatever, but they'd never be as forward
which is normal and allowable. If you want to give them your Snapchat, you can, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's... But you're saying it's older men that are insulting a 16-year-old young woman?
Yeah.
Okay. Did your manager say, I think, or even you, or indeed your mum, Annie, would you think of telling the Gardaí? Annie, would you think of telling the Gardaí?
Where the Chip Van is, it's quite in the middle of the town. So they be up and down and call and check on them and stuff like that. But I think, like everything, you kind of get the feeling that you'd ring them, but by the time they come down, it's gone. And they have to give them a warning. I'm not quite sure there's still a way of stopping them coming up to the van. It's not, as you say, it's not an indoor premises or anything like that. And I mean, I've given Saoirse actually the number of the local station and told her, please do not be afraid to ring them or ring us if you need help, or ring us to come in, or ring the boss and he will drive down or whatever. But
and
a lot of the time,
you
can't hide that you're ringing them.
That's true.
Because, you know, you're standing there at the counter. You've nowhere to go. You don't have a back room to go. If they want to go to the toilet, they have to leave and go to the kind of public toilets that's across the square. And, you know, you put in your 50 cents. They don't have anywhere to hide to make a phone call or anything like that. So I suppose the other part of it is that they're afraid to antagonise the person, unless in the hope that if you say you're ringing the guards, they might back away.
Mm-hmm.
But
the danger is, and you're trapped in that van.
It is a very small space. There's only enough for the two of them really in it to work. And there's a side door that they climb in and out, but it's quite awkward. There's nowhere to hide. There's nowhere to go. Yeah. And if they climb out of it, they have the worry, I suppose, that the person might come around the side to them and they're back in their space.
And they do do that.
Say again, Saoirse, what were you saying there?
They do come around the side. Like, if it gets a bit too much for me, I might ask if I could just step out the side if I have my part of whatever I'm doing done.
Mm-hmm.
And I have had a few occasions where he would actually walk around the side of the van and try and talk to me.
So you really feel trapped.
And there is nowhere really for me to go.
Yeah, you're trapped. You're trapped.
Just walk off.
You're trapped. It'd be no harm, Saoirse, and Annie, and the manager, just telling the Gardaí about it. And maybe they'll give it. There is a text line now, I think. Isn't there a text line now for Gardaí that you could be texting rather than having to, you say you're really vulnerable, because they can see. It's not as if you can stand into the back room and phone the Gardaí, because there's no back room in these pop-up coffee shops and chip vans or whatever, which are doing such great work around the country. Okay, Saoirse Roach, thanks indeed, and mind yourself, Saoirse. It's great that you're working during the summer. Fair play to you. Annie Roach also, thanks indeed. joe@rte.ie, 51551 is the text number.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
And joe@rt.ie. This morning we received a copy of the confidential report compiled by the Jesuits, 50 pages, into Joseph Marmion, they're now calling him, a former, well, he's, as far as they're concerned, it's on his headstone, Father Joseph Marmion, in the Jesuit plot up in Glasnevin. And the report is on foot of allegations made on this programme and indeed initiated by the journalist Tom Durley. And subsequently other people came forward here. Now, Ruchard O'Tierney. Ruchard, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe.
How are you doing? You were on with us before. Have you read this report, Ruchard?
I have, yeah.
And what do you think? Would you be able to give a summary? Because it's pretty damning. One, about Marmion, but two, about themselves and the Jesuits, the way they handled it.
It is a report. It is a summary of Joseph Marmion's complete career as a Jesuit priest and his upbringing in England and all the interactions that the Jesuit order had with him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, as you say, they are very contrite, but there's a lack of documentation for the most serious aspects of the whole scandal.
There was the Jesuit principal in Belvedere, Noel Barber, got a complaint through Paul Andrews, another Jesuit, and he called in Marmion. There's no written record available of what happened, except that
the whole thing about Andrews got a phone call from a friend of a friend, who the friend of the friend heard his son on the telephone talking about what happened in Vienna. Like, that's a cock and bull story. Do you know what I mean? You know, that's, and I don't think really very many people actually believe that. But there you go.
And this is an extract from the report. As understood by Father Barber at the time, the matter had been brought to the attention of the college authorities in order that they would deal with it. Father Barber accepts that between Father Doyle, Father Andrews and himself, there was concern that what had happened ought not to become known. He believed he was acting in the interest of the institution in protecting, where have we heard this before, in protecting it from scandal. The question of reporting the matter to the Gardaí did not arise in any conversation at that time. Now, that is not 1948, where, as they say in the report here, they had reservations about Marmion in 1948. This is 1977, where they say they got the first credible allegation. But they didn't, in 1977, they didn't even think of going to the Gardaí about this crime.
Well, Joe, I know for at least one instance of a guy in my year whose parents had to go to Noel Barber because the classmate was being perpetually humiliated in class, and to the extent that he didn't want to go back to school. And so the idea that... The idea that hearing the reports about what happened in Vienna in 1977 was the first time anyone ever realized that there was something wrong here is kind of, no one believes that. And that isn't credible.
But in terms of the authority, okay, previously there had been complaints about Marmion's behaviour to students being very rough, humiliating them. There are complaints about his sexual innuendo and his jokes, both within the community of the Jesuits. They said he brought tension and trouble wherever he went, be it the Crescent in Limerick or indeed Belvedere in Dublin. And so, but the sexual nature of the allegation, they say they only became aware of it in 1977. And that's when they should have told the Gardaí, and they didn't.
That's absolutely correct. The degree to which anyone knew about sexual misbehaviour on his part is difficult to work out. Everybody's still trying to work it out. I mean, we knew of stories where boys were having to go to have their costumes fitted for the opera, and then he would disappear behind a screen. And we couldn't really make where the boys were in naked or semi-naked or whatever. We only now realize that he was masturbating behind the screen. Oh, at the time, we didn't really, no one really knew. Now, there were cases that went beyond that. But it's like, for example, when I told my dad about what had happened in Vienna, that was the first time he had ever was aware of anything like that. So maybe some of the Jesuits knew, maybe they didn't. The other thing that comes out of the report that I find interesting, most interesting, is that Marmion's role in Belvedere was that of, in the community there, was of counsellor. he was the one keeping an eye on all the priests there and reporting back to the Father Provincial. Yeah. So essentially, he was more powerful than the head of studies or the rector.
And is your and your father's role in this in mentioned in this report?
Yeah, it is. But unfortunately, Father Barber can't remember my dad coming to see him, though he doesn't dispute that the meeting did happen.
Well, in Father Barber's evidence about that day, he got the phone call from Father Andrews to say he's got a very good friend of his has told him that Joseph Marmion abused children he was the only one on the trip from the Jesuits to Vienna, the annual trip. I think it went on for 5 weeks. Incredible. Within a short time of the same day, this is from the report, Joseph Marmion, they don't refer to him as Father Joseph in any of the report, by the way, maybe he has been defrocked or whatever, posthumously, having spoken to Father Andrews, approached Father Barber in the common area. This is Marmion approaching Barber, preempting Father Barber's intention of seeking a meeting with him. This is how powerful this man is and smart, so to speak, as they all are, pedophiles.
Yep.
Father Barber decided that he and Joseph Marmion would walk instead of speaking where they were then standing. During the course of the walk, Joseph Marmion spoke of the behaviours on his part, which caused Father Barber to believe that what the intermediary had described could be true. Joseph Marmion said that he'd been teaching the boys, and again a warning which I should have given, unfortunately, at the start of this for young years, parents make judgments, please, spoke of behaviour which caused Father Barber to believe that the intermediary had described what he had described could be true. Joseph Marmion said he'd been teaching the boys how to keep their genitals clean, and this involved touching their genitals. He referred to boys stripping in his presence, and this had arisen in the course of undressing for the opera. Father Barber's recollection is that this was described as something that had been happening in the changing area of number 9 Denmark Street, Great Denmark Street, which is where Belvedere is, in Dublin City, which was on the top of the old junior school. Father Barber was particularly taken aback by a statement from Joseph Marmion. I didn't even have an erection, although Joseph Marmion strongly denied that he had acted improperly in any way. Father Barber formed a view, from what he had said, Marmion, that he was using the boys for his own sexual gratification. Father Barber immediately recounted this conversation to Father Andrews. The impression he formed was that Father Andrews had a broadly similar conversation. So what do they do with Marmion? They move him.
Yes, that's right. But the thing about it, one has to realise, I think, Joe, at the same time, Father Barber was in an invidious position. Mm-hmm. Andrews was a very close friend of Joseph Marmion's. In the report, there is a letter of a nervous from Joseph Marmion in the 60s, in which he recounts to Father Andrews a nervous breakdown which he had. So they were pals. Andrews and Father Marmion were pals. And another aspect to it as well is that Joseph Marmion, it also comes through in the report, not only is he the councillor reporting on the Belvedere community to the provincial, but he is also the leading opponent of Vatican II among the mm-hmm. Jesuit community in Belvedere, bullying the younger priests who are more progressive thinking. And perhaps, and so this is also, he's a very powerful figure, and his granduncle is in the course of being beatified.
Marmion's granduncle, yeah, as a Jesuit.
Yes.
Beatified.
So essentially, he was practically untouchable for, so, I mean, Barber was extremely difficult.
But even though these two men admit now that they believed the allegations to be true in 1977, not only did they not go to the Gardaí, where they should have gone immediately, and not only, okay, they moved him, but they took their time in moving him. They let him finish the academic year.
And yes, then, I know there's a lot of people very angry about that.
Yeah, they let him finish the academic year. And also, they say we removed him from the school opera that year, which is an institution in Belvedere and highly regarded. But they removed him from producing the school opera that year. Okay.
Yes.
But they didn't tell Jerry Haw, who's much respected and deceased, unfortunately, who took over responsibility for the opera, and Jerry was widely regarded in Belvedere. But they didn't inform Jerry the reason why Barber had been removed. And in fact, they allowed Marmion to play the piano in the opera, to continue working on it. But anyway, there's a buzz coming through there. Okay, that's your phone buzzing.
Sorry.
That's your phone buzzing.
That was my recharger.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll go to Mark Harold. Mark, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe.
Have you read through this internal? The Jesuits, by the way, say this is a confidential and internal report, and it's ongoing. So we're they didn't even provide us with a spokesperson when all these allegations were being made on Liveline, even though in the report they do quote Noel Barber, who was listening to Liveline, saying that he heard one particular caller on Liveline make allegations, and Noel Barber says these allegations to me sound like are true. So it's not that they had an issue with Liveline as such, but they just wouldn't come on. Now they're saying we won't come on because it's confidential and ongoing. Mark Harold, Mark, you've read the report. What do you think of it?
Well, I think there's a lot of gaps. I think it's written by legal people. I think it's somehow minimise the, of course they've acknowledged some of the wrongdoing, but it does seem to be couched in legalese terms. There's many, many gaps in it, as Ruckert pointed out there, and documents not available. All probably designed to minimise the awful scandal that it is. Having said that, mm-hmm. I think that there has been an acknowledgement that the choice was made clearly consciously to protect the reputation of the school over the health and safety of the of boys. What's striking, Joe, for me is that this chap's cards were marked, as mm-hmm. you said, from the late 40s. They knew he was a bad, bad apple. And yet he seemed to have been given free rein. And indeed, there's a suggestion that his appointment, say, to Clongowes, for instance, was made above the head of the Irish provincial mm-hmm. at the time, which was very concerning. And just that mention about that whole beatification process for his granduncle. So it may have been a series of unfortunate happenings that came together that allowed this chap free rein to vulnerable children. I still don't understand why. I mean, I was there for his 10 years, or the 10, like 69 to 79, mm-hmm. How they at that point could have stood over allowing, free rein to vulnerable children. And it was the vulnerable young boys that he targeted, unfortunately, both sexually and the psychological bullying that, people I've spoken to 50 years on are still badly affected by it. But then, subsequent to that, he went to Paris for a year, but then back to Gardiner Street, around the corner, where many of his victims were aware that, he was there and actually saw this chap. There was a decree, from the Vatican that all sexual abuse cases, after the mm-hmm. in the 90s, after the issues were being revealed, and nothing happened again. And for those people who, within my school, which was Belvedere, who had been affected by this individual, made the damage that much worse. It compounded the hurt and the psychological injury, if you like, of his actions. Yeah. And sitting on it for 50 years. I mean, there was even a suggestion almost towards the end, that, well, we decided, now to come forward. Almost like, well, had we decided not to, we'd have got away with that as well. And I didn't like that. I mean, let's face it, Joe, we're dealing with a very powerful institution mm-hmm. who have long tentacles. And my appeal to them on your show is stop the games. Let's just conclude this in a mature manner and get rid of the legalese, to get rid of the sort of the strategizing, and let's just meet up and sort out. I mean, I sort out the issues. I think ultimately, there will need to be a redress scheme. There will need to be facilities for people who simply haven't been able to come forward in light of this very public,
They say this. I think they say at one stage in the report that they've received 25 complaints already this year about Marmion. 25 individuals.
Yeah. Joe, in my view, there's been complaints received about him since...
Of course.
73,
yeah.
You know.
You say 73, yeah.
Oh,
they
yeah.
say 77.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
But in the report, yeah. Mark, the term... it's 52 page. The term sexual abuse appears 40 times. The term rape does not appear, which is contrary to what we heard earlier on this year. The term... some of the crimes committed by Marmion. The term paedophile appears twice, but one of them is a quote from Tom Dooley's book, which was published in 2004. And
right.
they did nothing. But like in 1993, again in their report, on the occasion of Joseph Marmion's Golden Jubilee, and as you know, Golden Jubilee of becoming a priest is always celebrated. These were the notes, the testimonial notes publicly said about Joseph Marmion. Now remember, 18 years earlier, 16 years earlier, they... from the same report, Father Noel Barber, his boss at the time, and Father Andrews both believed that the allegations of sexual abuse that they were made against Marmion were true. But in 1993, which is 16 years later, this is what the Jesuits said about him publicly. His dedication to the hospital ministry, he was a chaplain in a big Dublin hospital, is rooted in his devotion to the daily Eucharist. He's a very hard worker, yet always available to do another job to oblige a friend. He's a lively sense of humour and a great wit, a man of many talents. For years, a very successful producer of school operas. He's a writer of short stories and combines all of this with adult education and retreat work. Joseph helps the diffident Jesuit in the preparation of homilies and encourages them. His mother was noted for her selfless generosity, a characteristic passed on to him. I'm surprised he didn't nominate him for sainthood. Knowing
yeah.
for 16 years, at least, you say 20, knowing for 16 years that he was a sexual abuser of children.
You know, Joe, I hate to admit
and by
it.
The way, sorry, just in fairness to the Jesuit, I have to be fair, the society is ashamed of this characterisation of Joseph Marmion.
Yeah. Well, I hate to admit it, but he had many of those characteristics. He was a very bright man.
Yeah.
He was a charming man in a lot of people's eyes, not in mine, I can tell you, or any of his victims. But the mothers, you know, thought he was a lovely man and this sort of stuff. But that's, I mean, there's a psychopathic element. That's what a good psychopath is able to do, you know, that you don't actually see beyond the facade. And like that, he did. My awareness was that those vulnerable children he targeted, he would say to them, "This is just what was reported to me. You can tell who you want, and I'll be denying it. You know, and who do you think is going to be believed?" So, this is the kind of thing the way you know he would have sort of functioned. Now, aside from like that, the report that he was a bully within his own community, so people were afraid, and I actually do believe that he had this extra cachet because of this grand uncle, you know, that I don't think anybody within the Jesuits or anybody sympathetic towards the sort of whole Jesuit sort of movement was wanting that to be revealed, and maybe that was an extra sort of preventer, you know, the thing that prevented the you know, something being done about him. And I mean, now we realise, I mean, it was absolutely, well, those of us who encountered him knew it was wrong at the time, but those people who could have done something about it and chose not to,
But they didn't even tell their own confreres in the Jesuit community. For example, when Marmion was, he got a year's holiday in Paris or whatever for his misdemeanors in Belvedere. Then he came back and was moved, as you say, there's another Jesuit community attached to the church in Gardner Street. And when he was sent to live there, so to speak, Belvedere never told, or indeed the authorities in the Jesuits, never told Gardner Street why he had been removed from the 500 yards away from Belvedere. And brother Tom Phelan, who's a Jesuit, and he's people would know him from his great work when he was in Gardner Street, in the Gardner Street community, he said he came to know Joseph when he lived there, and Tom would be in charge of the accommodation and sorting out everything and anything in the place, it seemed at the time. He was a larger-than-life character who took over the table on a drinks night. He tended to attract people who had a bit of negativity about the society for some reason. He had problems with authority. He was a gruff man, but also could be gentle as a lamb. He had a huge anger. Asked if he had any indication of the origin. Now, remember, Brother Tom Phelan's not been told why Marmion was kicked out of Belvedere, 500 yards away. Asked if he had any indication of the origin of this anger, he stated that somebody told him that he had to be taken out of Belvedere. Never anything specific. What I got was that he was too tough on the boys. This was just whispers. I know that in his years in Gardiner Street, he drank heavily and continually. I also know that he consumed a fair few tablets. Housekeeping had to pick them up from the floor of his bedroom. I don't know what the tablets were for. I was shocked when I learned earlier this year of his sexual abuse. It brings shame on us collectively. It's hard to work with people in the community if we all get tarred with the same brush. You hang your head with shame. The crime is horrendous, but the way we, the Jesuits, handled it made it even worse. Now, that's from one of their numbers, probably the most straightforward comment in the whole report.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree with that. But it's also light, the report is also light on his activities in Austria, because that, to me, like, that was the peak of his offences. It was criminal what he got away with, you know, and yet, from what we are being told, we can't say for 100% sure unless this is properly investigated. My understanding is that there's an Austrian newspaper now interested on foot of the publicity here, that this individual sort of was bringing groups over to Austria in the 70s. I mean, literally the setup of boys two floors down and his room up, you know, and him bringing individual boys up, being drugged, and being brought up drugged, and these kids had no memory. These are reports of what happened in their previous 24 hours in this room. Now, I can't say that is a fact. All I can say is that's what I've been told. And why that there isn't a concern for those boys within the report, I don't know, because that to me is terribly serious. But also, you know, this chap, his cards were marked from the 40s, the late 40s. And here we are in the mid-70s. You know, his reputation hadn't changed in any way, even what they're admitting, you know, publicly, that he was a very strange character. And yet he was allowed unfettered access to 25 boys for 3 weeks in Austria every year. It beggars belief that could happen in hindsight.
Rookard, I'm also thinking when I read out that piece, it just struck me about what Brother Tom Phelan said about the tablets. They were strewn everywhere. That there was allegations that he drugged, we heard him on this programme earlier in the year, that he drugged the young people in Vienna, in his room. We know he
probably... That's what I heard, and that's what I reported to my dad, and that's why my dad went to Barber. But one of the things that's in the report regarding Vienna, which is most interesting, is at that time, Marmion is going for something called profession, which I mean, I think you're a priest already, but now you can't be fired.
Okay, it's almost an ecclesiastical promotion, so to speak.
Yes. And there are ongoing discussions between between Rome, the head of the Jesuit order, Father Arupa, and the head of the Father Provincial in Ireland. And before the thing even has broken in Ireland in September of 1977, Rome comes back to the Father Provincial and says, "We have decided he's not going to get the profession."
So they had suspicions for some reason.
So there is the indication, there is perhaps someone reported him from Vienna, yes. And the other thing that one has to remember in this context is that Father Arupe at the time was the leading light of the liberation theology in the Catholic Church and in the Jesuit order. And Father Marmion was a proponent of the actual opposite end. He was a reactionary. He had his boys singing Nazis songs in his in choir practice. He was making jokes at the expense of the religion. In the report it says he doesn't even take the religion Christianity seriously.
I remember at the time somebody alerted us to that they couldn't find a copy of the obituary in the Clongonian, which is the annual produced by each college produced an annual every year, all the record of the year, who was there and teachers coming and going. But and we asked the Jesuits for a copy of that obituary, and we were unable to. I don't know if they said they couldn't find it, but they found it now because it's in this report. Uh-huh. And and it was published in 2001. Okay. And to say it's glowing, with a few little caveats about his sense of humour might be misunderstood a couple of times, but to say it's glowing is an understatement. And I don't. It doesn't say who wrote it. Was it one of his confreres?
Could I comment on that, Joe?
Yeah, yeah.
It was one of his confreres, and my understanding is, and there is nothing from this individual. I don't know if I'm...
No, you're not.
But it was one of the comments that many of the people I've spoken to since is there is nothing from this chap who was closest to the man himself. But that's my understanding is that that's who wrote that obituary.
Yeah, a lot of people are very disappointed about that, actually. The lack of engagement by the person who wrote that obituary with the whole process, yeah.
You know who wrote it? That's what you say.
Yes, okay. I do. Yeah.
Well, have you got a record of it being signed so we could prove that he wrote it?
No idea.
No, okay.
I wouldn't have. Yeah,
okay. I'll just give you one paragraph from it. That's probably this is the most critical paragraph you'll find in it. Those who, and remember, this is 2001, and the Jesuits know that this man is a paedophile. They say they've known since 1977, though they didn't report it to the Gardaí. Those who knew Joe best were always aware that he was not a man of short measures. At his best, he was generous, warm-hearted, loyal and true. But being a real human being, he also had some faults. He could be devastating in his disapproval. He took no hostages to fortune. If Father Joe disagreed with you, you always knew it at the earliest opportunity. He could do no other. Honour and personal integrity demanded such a course of action, no matter what the cost. But to all of those who knew him best were well aware of his great generosity and genuine concern. That's the most critical paragraph I can find in his obituary written. Was it written by a Jesuit? Don't give me the name.
Yes.
Is that Jesuit still alive?
Yes.
And why isn't that reference in this document that this obituary was written by one of our members? Could this member be totally naive and not know of the allegations against Joe Marmion over the previous three decades? We don't know.
We can't.
Okay.
But at the same time, I would say...
I wonder, does that person wish to publicly recant what they wrote about him? Now that they, without doubt, their own order is saying that he was a serial paedophile. They don't say he was a rapist, though we believe, and I know, is it yourself or Rockard or Mark believe that he... Mark, you believe that one of the acts he did commit was raping young boys?
Yes, I do. I do too, yeah.
Okay, well, the report is there. Thanks to whoever sent it. It's not in the public domain. Hopefully it will be in terms of people can read it from beginning to end.
Might I say at the end, Joe, I do think the current Father Provincial Leonard Maloney is trying to do his very best to make to tidy up all this mess. And I've been very impressed, and so have most of the people I've been talking to, with the facilitators, Barbara Walsh and Catherine O'Connell, who the Jesuits have asked to deal with this whole matter. They're great people.
But is it not fair to say, Mark, and indeed Rookard, this report at face value in their admissions is going to cause serious problems for the Jesuit order in Ireland, even financially?
No idea. I'd be speculating if we were to answer that question.
Okay.
Well, Rookard, I'm not in full agreement with you on the observation around. I know Leonard Maloney, and I know he's just fronting an institution, but they've sat on this for 50 years, and as I say, the damage done. It got worse and worse for so many people, and people are really suffering now. I mean, the numbers to me that are supposedly coming forward are quite irrelevant, because there's many people who are simply not capable of coming forward.
And I
also have concerns about two lovely women, but they were appointed and are being paid for by the Jesuits, these facilitators. Yeah. So to me, as somebody said, it's like the fox looking after the guarding the hen house. it's not necessarily an objective for people who feel really damaged and mistrustful. And let's face it, sitting on your hands for 50 years, you would engender that. So I wouldn't be one of the ones who, I remain to be convinced, put it that way. As I say, there was nobody involved from the victim side in the appointment. Mm. It just happened. So, it's not universal, that sort of sense. I remain to be convinced. That's the way I would put it.
Well, do you think the Gardaí should be involved?
Well, there's no question. Of course they should. I mean, if children have been raped, of course they should. You know, and there's no call for that in the report. It needs to be somebody objective, somebody outside of the institution. With the best will in the world, it's going to be very difficult for them to be objective about the crimes that this man committed.
As I say, it's not just the crimes that I think I'm trying to go back to that quote from Brother Tom Phelan of the Jesuits. He said it wasn't just one. He wasn't told when Marmion was sent to him why he was being sent to live around the corner from the school. And it's only this year he learned of the sexual abuse allegations. And he's even more critical of the way the author handled them in this case. And also, I can also tell you, Mark and Ruckard, since we start talking about this today, we received another call from another man who says he was a victim who's never come forward before. So this is only opening.
Yeah, my heart goes out, Joe, to people who are finding it very, very difficult. I mean, some people are re-traumatized by the and further by, you know, the paucity of information, say, on something like this. No recollection, no files, no this. You know, that exacerbates the pain for people, and it sort of re-traumatizes them in some ways, it's, you know, this denial that has gone on for 50 didn't happen. No, we got one little report or one little complaint here in 1977, whatever. There was an avalanche of complaints,
and the only reference to 1973, which is where our callers like yourselves are saying the first reports were made. Father Barber, Noel Barber, heard on the radio in 2021, that was Liveline, we've checked it, a former pupil speaking about his suspension from Belvedere in either 1973 or 1974, following an argument between the former pupil and Joseph Marmion. Father Barber recalls this episode and that the former pupil refused to accede to an unreasonable demand made by Joseph Marmion with regard to the matter. Father Barber considered the former pupil's account on radio to be fair and accurate. So this 73 event is now regarded as true, where Marmion got a student suspended because the student obviously stood up to him. But anyway, this is not over yet by any stretch. Mark,
but there was a chap in my year, I'm now not going to mention his name, and he couldn't take Marmion's crap anymore, and he challenged him to a fight. And he got the crap beaten out of him.
Right. Okay, Ruckard O'Tierney, good morning. And Mark Harold also, thank you both. Joe with RT.
Thank you
both.
Thank you, Joe.
Joe with RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Back to Saoirse Roach, indeed Annie Roach, her mother, both of them were on to us about the sexual abuse, in terms of verbal abuse, which she's receiving since she started working in one of these phenomena of the epidemic, these vans that serve as chip shops and coffee shops or whatever, where you're basically you're trapped in the van. You can't say you can't escape. You can't go into a back room, and you can't stop the patrons coming up to the counter because there's no door as such. It's self-evident. Maura, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
What happened to you when you said you were a waitress?
Yes, I was a waitress. I was about 24. I worked in a restaurant bar just, I had a day job as well. This was just something to do at night, earn a few bob.
Yeah.
And I remember one night I had a full tray of drinks, and this businessman, a very wealthy businessman, he just stood up, grabbed me by the genitals. I dropped the tray and slapped his face.
Good woman.
Now, that man died shortly after that. Okay. I said to one of your researchers, that nothing to do with me. But he's gone anyway.
But in public, he grabbed your private
he
parts.
He did. It was a pact. It was a very popular place that I worked. This was up the north. It was very, very popular. Lovely clientele who come in. People with money. Golf clubs things used to be said to me as well. I worked in golf clubs. All these men, these powerful men, so-called, they think they could just touch you and talk to you the way they did. But what made me think then, Joe, God love this. I mean, that's only a child. She's 16. I was reading David Walsh in the back of the paper, the Irish Times. About
Sunday Times. Sunday Times.
Yeah. Oh, Sunday Times, yeah, sorry. Yeah. And the team who were playing, I'm a bit nervous now, Joe, sorry.
Take your time. Yeah.
European Beach Handball Championship in Bulgaria last weekend. They were fined for not wearing bikini bottoms.
They wore shorts.
It's absolutely outrageous. I'm so fuming. I was just doing the dishes here. And I heard the young girl. My goodness, whoever's running that business should get that man and talk to him and bar him completely. It's just not on, Joe.
But how do you bar somebody from a pop-up chip van or coffee
shop? It depends where it is, Joe, I suppose. If it's next to a pub.
It's on a main street.
Is it next to pub?
I don't know. It's a chip shop. Maura, by the way, when you slapped him, what happened next?
Actually, Joe, would you believe I cannot remember? I'm 70 now.
Okay.
I can't remember. I left the job. I did leave it.
Yeah. Oh, did you?
I did. And I had a very nice boss. He was a lovely man. Very nice boss. So I just wiped it out of my mind. But lots of those things just happened to me. I remember I worked for a neighbour of mine too. This is all bringing it back, this poor child. Mm-hmm. And he became very, very wealthy, extremely a billionaire, this man. And he lived beside us in a housing estate where I lived.
Okay.
And I used to babysit his children. And I did a lot of promotion work.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me a lift back to the hotel where we... Because I knew him. I was talking to him. I knew him.
Mm-hmm.
And where we were having... We had to stay overnight or something to do a promotion. And he knocked the door in the bedroom and I opened it. And he came in and started to go for me. And I ran round, actually, the bed, a big bed. And I said to him, stop this. I said, you know my mammy. Now, I was 24. And he stopped dead in his tracks and left the room. So, Joe, this is out. I mean, this is 2021. I was about 23 then, too. This is outrageous. It really makes me so mad.
And this young woman is 16.
She's a child.
And the men who are verbally abusing her are in their 40s.
Correct. That happened to me. You see, it's all about control and power, Joe. That's what they think they have.
Okay, let's hear Ruth as well, Maura. Stay there, Maura.
Okay,
Ruth, good
Joe.
Afternoon. Joe at rt.ie. Go ahead, Ruth.
Hi, Joe. Thanks very much for having me on.
Yeah.
Like Maura as well, I was raised when I heard about what's going on with Saoirse and about the idea that there was a back room that she had to go to because very typical in that situation, it was Saoirse's responsibility or like it's considered her responsibility to remove herself.
Yeah, good point.
There's no social or maybe there is legal if you're going to go through all that hassle, but there's no social repercussions for a man like that. He probably wasn't alone, like the 40-year-old who began to abuse the other colleague as well when she interfered.
So your point is that Saoirse should not have to run away somewhere else.
Yeah.
The man should be either arrested or chased away.
It shouldn't be, but it's not even the legality. It's our society.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay for men to do that. It's funny. At worst, he was a bit of a whatever for doing that. There's no repercussions. He wouldn't be blacklisted for that. Whereas if Saoirse, maybe not in that situation, but in many situations, you know, women are labelled as difficult or the problem or just taken as a compliment.
Oh, you have no sense of humour. That's the other
no
thing, isn't it?
That's a big one. No sense of humour.
Yeah.
And it's the woman's responsibility. This is the whole societal thing of, well, why were you there? Like, why were you down the corridor by yourself? Why did you go to the bathroom alone? Why were you wearing that? There's nothing about the men. Boys will be boys. Like, this isn't grow overnight. This is from day one, they're told it's not their fault. But you know what I mean? It is a society that there's no consequence to treating women like objects, and especially young women. As long as you look, if you look good, that's your problem, nearly. Of, do you know what I mean? Of, you should be, take it as a compliment that you're getting this attention.
Okay. Is Ruth and Maura, is harassment and hassle normal for women in your experience?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Okay.
Your researcher asked me what I've been harassed. Yeah. I was like, no, not really, just the normal stuff. Not really harassment of, you know, being grabbed or my arse being smacked or being shouted things when I'm walking alone, or, like, you know, even not even that, just even remarks and creepy remarks and continuous remarks. I'm like, that's not harassment because, oh, well, why? Because I've been told it's not harassment. It's just a bit of fun, a bit of attention.
Yeah. Okay.
Sons are, good, rare sons don't do that, Joe.
Good point.
No,
good point.
And that's the truth.
Okay, thank you indeed. Thank you, Ruth.
Okay, Joe.
And thank you, Maura.
And thank you for listening. Okay.
And thank you for contacting.
I support Saoirse.
Yeah, of course.
Great one.
Okay.
Joe@rte.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Back to the Jesuit report on one of their number, Father Joseph Marmion, even though they refer to him as Joseph Marmion throughout the report, but he's buried in the Jesuit plot in Glasnevin and in full ecclesiastical nomenclature. John Sheridan, you didn't know the report was out.
I don't know. The first I was aware of it is my partner told me that it was on your show there this afternoon.
Yeah.
I have no notification whatsoever about it, neither emails, letters, or nothing.
And did you contribute to it? Were you questioned by them?
Well, I phoned up the helpline.
Okay.
And they said the girl that answered, I just haven't got her name to hand here in front of me. But anyway, she said to me, we can't talk to you at the moment because we're inundated with calls. And she said to her, I certainly will follow this up and come back to you. So she came back to me within 2 days.
Okay.
And I talked to her at length about the problems with Joe Marmion.
Yeah.
And she took all the details down and she said, we'll be in touch.
And did those details include an email address and a postal address?
Oh, everything.
Okay, so they should have sent you a copy of the report.
Well, yeah, because they had my email, because I got an email to contact the college if I had any issues as well there, you know.
And the Jesuits told us today, when they said they didn't want to talk about this and wondered where we got the report, they say that it's an ongoing report and they've sent it to people who contributed, but you didn't. You contributed, but you didn't get it.
No, whatsoever. And prior to your show being aired, I was talking to a chap that was in school with me. He actually was on your radio show before I was.
Mm-hmm.
And to the best of my knowledge, he said to me that he wasn't contacted either.
And what was your, I know it was Marmion was in Clongowes in what, the early 60s?
60s, yeah.
And what was your encounters with him?
Well, I mean, the beatings I got from him and intimidation and everything like that, you know.
And we heard about, it was the first time I ever heard of a thing called a pandy bat.
Oh, the pandy bat, yeah, that's a famous. Well, it's exclusive to the Jesuits. It's a leather strap with weights either side of it, you know.
And what would Marmion do to you?
It'd make you drop your trousers or your pyjamas, which mainly was your pyjamas, and he'd give you six of the best across your bottom.
Your bare bottom, my God.
Bare bottom, oh yeah.
And you put this to the committee that was set up by the Jesuits to investigate themselves, and it's only when you'll see, it's 52 pages long, I can't find any, well, there is a mention of the pandy bat in it actually, but I don't know if it's in relation to the, and were you understanding, John, when they contacted you for a statement, were you giving evidence or were you just having a conversation?
No, it was a conversation that was to be followed up.
Okay. And it hasn't been followed up?
No. Okay. And as I say, the other person I talked to was on your show. I gave your researcher his name because he wouldn't have an issue with that. But he hasn't been contacted either.
Okay. As far as we can find, well, not in the appendix, which has this glowing obituary that the Jesuits wrote about this man when he died, something like 30 years after they knew he was a paedophile. But I can only find one testimony, and that's, I don't know if the name is even have been changed for obvious reasons, but there's only one testimony from one young boy, and I think that man has been on our programme actually when I read the testimony. There's no testimony from anyone else, so to speak. And he says, Father Marmion laid into me with his pandy bats on the hands, arms, face, back and backside for what seemed like a lifetime. Does that sound like your words, John? In fairness.
No, that,
no,
that's
no a, they're not.
It,
that's
certainly, it wasn't hit across the face.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's
would have been on the hands and the bottom.
Well, then that's a completely different testimony. Father Marmion laid into me with his pandy bat. What a name. His pandy bat on the hands, arm, face, back and backside for what seemed like a lifetime. Okay, it's not over yet, John, the way this is unfolding.
I mean, since I was on your programme, I met a chap that was in he lives local to me, and he said to me, he said, you know, he said he was an awful, I won't repeat the word over the phone, but I said, and what happened to you? And he said he used to beat the living daylights out of me. But the amount of people that I'd imagine this has happened to, it hasn't come to light because things were just covered up. You know, people are afraid to say the way they were treated by him anyway. You know, a certain amount of shame attached to it there anyway, you know.
Okay, okay. Thanks indeed. Thanks indeed.
But I certainly, the first I heard about the document was when I heard about the announcement on your show. Nobody from either Clongowes or any member of the Jesuits contacted me anyway, you know.
Yeah. Okay, John. Thanks indeed. That's John Sheridan in Dublin. Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Last week we were talking about people who've been married for a very, very long time, including one couple, I think, who were 75 years married. We got talking to them at the end of the week. But Philomena McCormack contacted us. And Philomena, you're saying you were, unfortunately, Martin has passed, but you were married 63 years to Martin McCormack, I presume, who had a travelling cinema. And we went into funfairs and swing boats. But you lost them in February of this year. What happened, Philomena?
Well, he just got ill and he had double pneumonia and he wasn't able to overcome it.
Okay.
Yeah, he had flu down his lungs.
And he died in February.
He died the 19th of February. And we had our anniversary while he was in hospital on the 13th of February. And we were married Friday the 13th in 1953.
Well done. And
it was lucky for us.
Tell us about the travelling cinema.
Yeah, well, his father and himself and his brothers ran a mobile cinema. We'd travel from one town to another with a mobile cinema with all the good films at the time and all the comedies and everything. And he came to the village hall in Clonard. And I met him, I was only 17, and we both fell in love, and we got married when I was 18, and
Brilliant. We
never were a minute apart.
And what did the travelling, was it like a circus, the travelling cinema?
No, it was a fit-up with a screen and a machine, the big reels of machine for showing the films, and it was in a caravan, and they showed it out through it, you know, on a lens.
Okay, out through the window of the caravan.
Out through the window, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and the crowds we had, we went all over Ireland.
And where would the seats come from? Like,
yeah, you just built them up like a circus.
Oh, like a circus, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
The very same.
Okay. And how would you make your money, Philomena?
Well, you just have to stand at the door and take it in your hand.
Okay. And who would you have to pay for the rent of the site or the use of the hall?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Okay. Yes. It wasn't very high then, Joe.
Of course not. Of course not.
No, wasn't very high.
And what did you show? Were they popular films or were they older films?
Oh, yeah, very popular of the day. They had a lot of Laurel and Hardy's and a lot of the comedies. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very... And I'll tell you one thing that used to draw crowds around Wexford was they had the bombing of Camp Ryan.
Ah, The Patty News, like the news.
Yeah, the newsreels. The tragedy in Campire, yeah. The plane that killed the girls in the office.
Okay. Now, isn't would you where there was a fun fair you might set up, or where there was a fundraising?
No, we gave up the cinema because times got bad. The mobile cinemas, you had all the big popular cinemas.
Yeah, yeah.
So we started up with swinging boats and chair planes and dodgings, and we went from good to good until the 90s when the World Cup was on with Jack Charlton. Things were very, very poor that year for us.
What, everyone was watching Italian 90, everyone was watching the matches.
Including myself.
During the summer, okay.
Yes, indeed.
Well, I'm just thinking, one of the things that I think has been so badly missed during the pandemic, and I've seen no earthly reason why they're not back, is the circus. The circuses are off.
Oh, yes, Fawcett Circus went back on the road last week.
Yeah, but what happened, they were opening in Athy and they were hit by that thunderstorm.
That's right. So that's bad luck. My son was telling me that. He lives in Tremor.
But if you take the sides off a big top, which can easily be done, there's full ventilation. Like Duffy's Circus, which is our oldest circus, is not back on the road. And there'll be a whole generation of children who will never have experienced a circus. And remember, the circus, and like what you were doing, Philomena, the circus is the form of live entertainment that most people in the country are introduced to first. It's not the Abbey Theatre, the Gay Theatre, whatever, no matter how good they are, but it's the circus where they see live performance, and it gives you a great, great thrill. And the sooner the better they let the circuses go back on the road with their open big tops. But Philomena, when did Martin fall ill?
Well, he fell ill on the Monday before Christmas.
Okay.
We just noticed a little turn in him here, and he was very trembling, and we called the ambulance and he went to Mullingar Hospital, and they were very, very good there to him, no doubt about it, but there was little could be done.
And up to then, you'd never spent any time apart?
Only if he did have to go to hospital for minor
disease. Yeah, of course,
He was a very healthy man, actually.
Yeah. Oh God!
And his own mother died when he was 3, and his dad married a lovely lady from Wicklow, an old gem, and they had 2 boys, and one is still alive down in Fermoy in Cork. Ken is still alive.
And have you any idea how Martin got involved in the travelling cinema originally?
Oh no, the family, they were show people.
Ah, oh, great!
I was the outsider.
Show people. And the show people let in outsiders?
Pardon?
Do they let in? Do they welcome outsiders? Show people are
group. Yes. Yeah. No difference at all.
Okay. Well, it's
no difference at all.
Show people are great people, and I hope they all get back on their feet. When you look back on your, and I know Martin has passed, but when you look back on your long marriage, any tips? What's the recipe?
Children. We had 2 sons and a girl.
Okay.
The girl lives beside me here in a mobile home.
Okay. Okay, and you're all still close.
One son is married in Tremor, and my other son is married down the road here beside me.
Okay. Well, Philomena McCormick, you sound great, and I'm sorry that Martin passed.
I have three great grandchildren.
Oh, well done. I hope they know the great granddad and the great grandmammy's story, because it's a great part of Irish social history, the travelling cinema. Thanks indeed, Philomena McCormick.
Thank you very much, Joe. Thanks a million.
You mind yourself. You bring back the circus, I say. You let the circuses back out. Produced by series producer Rebecca Meehan, and sound was Mark McGrath. Daniel Keating was a BCO on Ray Darcy next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. For more on our 212 offers, visit your local Kia dealer or log on to kia.com.
1850 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.